The reading this morning is from Romans chapter 8, verses 28 through 30. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. I caveat prayers this morning as we come to God's word, knowing that really and truthfully, whatever I'm going to say will not justify the wonder of this verse. Romans 8:28 is one of the great promises in the Bible. It's a promise in a time of affliction. It's a promise for a time of suffering. But don't be fooled. Romans 8:28 is more than just an ask for healing or comfort. It's a promise that your suffering isn't pointless. It's a promise that says, as I stare hard things in the face, whatever happens is not meaningless, that God is doing something in the middle of those things. So, you know, I would just say to you, encourage you, you should memorize this verse. It's not very hard. It won't take you very long. You should memorize it. You should preach it to yourself regularly. Romans 8:28 says that God works all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And it's very simple this morning. I want to show you this morning why this is such an unbreakable and incomparable promise for you who knows Christ. All right, let's do a little Bible work before we begin. I want to just quickly define three things, and then I want to get into how this verse works. So I want to define for a second to whom this promise is given, because I think that's a big deal. The verse says it's given to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And I think there's a great grace in both of those statements, because there is, if you only took the first part, that God only works for good for those who love God, an abuse that could happen. That is, when bad things happen to us, very often, I've come across this very often, there could be this feeling that, wow, maybe I don't love God enough because bad things are happening to me. But look at what the verse says. It's not simply those who love God. It's those who are called according to God's purpose. So God's action in calling you, your action in loving him are combined to define to whom this promise is given. Let me say one brief other thing about this. God is not working all things for good for the unbeliever. It's not the promise. I didn't write it. We can't make that claim. This is a specifically sweet promise given to those that love God and are called according to his purpose. Secondly, let me define the good here. What is the good that God is working for us? If we took a poll in this room, we could probably come up with an infinite number of definitions of what each of us considers to be the good. But the good that is spoken of in this verse, it's not human defined, it's God defined. The good that is being spoken of here isn't more comfort, isn't more pleasure, isn't more success, isn't more approval, isn't more security. The good that God speaks of is defined by his character. It's defined by his holiness. When God says he's working all things for good, he's saying I'm working all things so that everything would reflect my character and my holiness in the world. Now, that may not sound like a lot of good to you. If you're not like a church-going person, that may be a rough good. And I get that. That's understandable. But I think the thesis of the Bible and of really, frankly, all of Christianity is the most beautiful, the greatest good that could be would be for God's holiness to reign in our lives. That is, God's character finds its way into different parts of our life, the greatest good comes. That God's holiness leads to my happiness. This little word, all. God works all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. That is a great word. It's that not that God is working some things for good in our life and other things he's ignoring. God is working all things, every square inch, every event, every relationship, every situation. If I love God and called according to his purpose, he is using to direct toward my greatest good. Nothing in your life is meaningless. Nothing is beyond the control of God. He's working all things. Well, let's get into this a second, this idea of how this works. And I kind of want to do it three different ways, kind of like we did last week. There's three different ways that I think God works the good in the life of the Christian. The first is kind of a very obvious one. It's probably the one that you most often associate with. And I think that is when material and temporal relief. You know, that is, let's say that you're struggling through an illness and your prayer is that God would heal me and that God does heal you and that God was working all along to bring such relief in your life. Or maybe it's that, you know, you're going through a certain time of struggle and let's say work is really difficult and you don't know why and it's been a long slog and then all of a sudden God brings relief in that thing and you look back and you say, you know, I couldn't have gotten to here without directly going through here. There are times and places where God brings a material and a temporal good into our lives. You know, we had some friends that are our age that found out they're pregnant. And I mean, I know I am tremendously young and good looking and all those sorts of things, but the reality is when you're my age, you're not a spring chicken for having babies. And that was sort of a surprising thing, and they came over to tell us that. And when they told us that, of course, I was very excited. I always love when other people have babies. Always amazing. But, you know, there was a lot of trepidation in them, right? Which was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? How is this going to work? Like, we're going to be at her wedding, and everybody's going to wonder why her grandfather's walking her down the aisle, and, you know, on and on and on. And then, this is a really easy one, right? I'll give you a really easy example of this. But it's like, I know and you know that this is going to be hard, but God's going to work this for good. You know, they're going to look back in 20 years and go, we cannot imagine our life without this person a part of it. It's really simple. Sometimes what God does is a material blessing. And I know, you know, we don't want to be prosperity gospel here, but we also don't want to be ungrateful for the way that God works in the life of a believer, that he really does bring materially better things in this life to us. That's the easy one. You guys know that one. Let me work to the second one here, because this one's probably a little more gets in your crawl. Sometimes God works all things for good by making me more holy and teaching me who it is, so that's who he is. So there are times in the life of a believer where God is teaching and disciplining us toward better things. This is the situation where the struggle becomes the crucible through which God leads me to a greater knowledge of himself or conformity to his son or awareness of my sin. That is very often the way God works in the life of a believer. And look, I have watched this over and over again as pastor over the years, as your pastor. I've seen this in your life. Real growth is usually hard. Real growth typically comes through trial and struggle. And I don't, You know, I don't know that that's how we typically think of it. Like, we, you know, when we imagine growth, I think sometimes we think like we're going to be sitting in the middle of a sermon, or we're going to be a Bible study, or we're going to be in prayer, and God's going to whisper this little truth, and we're going to be open-minded, and we're gonna hear it, and it's gonna soak in, and we're gonna go, aha, I really want to change everything in my life. We're gonna go out and make all the changes, everything's gonna be different. Folks, look, I've watched you. You don't do that. It would be a lot easier to grow spiritually if that was the way that it was. We grow in trial. We grow in difficulty. We grow in conflict. We grow when we have our backs against the wall and we have nothing else. We grow when everything on our body hurts. And there's a reason for that. You know, because if I'm going to take off sin and I'm going to put on Christ, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a surgery without anesthetics. It's going to be painful because sin is that deeply attached inside of me, and I love it far more than I want to admit. I don't want to give up the things that Jesus wants me to give up and move forward towards. And so sometimes he has to crank it out of there. So God brings suffering. He brings trial. And he does it in order to teach me and discipline me and work the good for me. He causes me to struggle that I might learn who he is, that I might put off sin, that I might look more like his son. I was listening to a podcast and they were interviewing Tim Keller. Tim Keller's If you don't know Tim Keller, you should learn who Tim Keller is. Great pastor for the past 20 years, and Tim Keller has terminal pancreatic cancer, which I don't know if there's another kind of pancreatic cancer. Most of the time, that's the way it ends up, right? And it's really sad because he's been a pastor for many in this country, and Keller's saying, "Look, I've got 1 or 2 or 3 years to live. We're not really sure, but you know that's kind of the way it goes." And then he says this. He said, "I know this sounds overly pietistic." He says, "It's really true." He said, "I am happier now with terminal cancer day to day than I ever was in my previous days." And when he says that, I want to say, you're such a liar. Don't lie. He's like, you know how that Christian blah, blah, you know how Christians can get with stuff like that? You're like, you're lying. Don't act like that's true. But I tell you, I don't know Keller personally, but he doesn't seem to me to be a person who lies or a person who sort of makes up things just to sound good. Like, I think he's actually telling the truth. And he says it. He goes on. He says, you know, for most of my life, I lived off of accomplishments. I lived off of meeting goals. You know, I'd get the book turned in. I'd start a gospel coalition. You know, we'd influence New York City for the gospel. And there'd be all, you know, his resume is long. He's been a tremendously successful tool of God. And he said, for years, that was what I rested on. And now, look, I've got terminal cancer. A week and a half out of every two, I can't do anything. All that stuff's taken from him. And he says, I'm happier now than I ever was before then. Stripped of everything else, all I have is Jesus. All I have to do is wake up in the morning and ask my wife, what should we eat for breakfast? And it's better. And I think that's crazy. But maybe it's true. Maybe the struggle and the suffering are really the tools of God for showing us who he is, for revealing to us our idolatries, for growing us and changing us and taking us to a place we never thought that we would look back and say, this is good. And I think what that means is for the likes of you and me. When we come into suffering and trial, you know, I understand how it is. My immediate response to anything that hurts is stop, change it, fix it, distract it, get rid of it, do whatever I can. Immediately, let's do it. But I think with this verse, I think this idea that God works all things for my good, what it tells us is when I enter those places, I need to grab on to the struggle and I need to say to God, God, what is it that you are doing here? What is it that I'm supposed to be knowing about you? How am I supposed to be relying on you? God, what sort of sin should I be removing from my life? What are you teaching me? Because Lord, I know you work all things for good for those who love you and are called according to your purposes. Third, this one's really important. You know, when Paul says that the Lord works all things for good for those who are called according to his purpose and who love him, that promise has an eschatological horizon to it. Okay, that's a big word, I know. Eschatological simply means like it is oriented to the end times. Right, I think this promise, and it's always been believed by Christians, is oriented toward the end of time. That we hold an eschatological hope in God's work for our good, and we hold it because there's two big events that go on in the life of God. The first is the resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus absolutely informs what is happening in Romans 8:28. The resurrection is the visible display of God's defeat of death. And what greater bad is there than death? What greater evil could there be than for you or one that you love to die of pancreatic cancer? How could there be any more final and seemingly ungood than death? What the resurrection does is prove that the worst that death can do is far too weak for God. The death doesn't have the final word, that even death won't thwart the promise of God to work all things for our good. So it is with the second coming. Romans 8:28 looks to the return of Jesus for the ultimate fulfillment of this promise. As the world closes in on us, and there is no seeming good to be found in the situation we find ourselves, we turn to the hope of the second coming of Jesus. There God will once and for all fulfill his promise to his people that everything that existed before this moment has been purposed toward the ultimate glory of Christ and our greatest good. Don't miss the fact that Romans 8:28 is absolutely an eschatological promise. It has the end in mind that whatever goes on, God has aimed that he will be for our greatest good in the resurrection and the return of Jesus, that all things will be made right in such a time. I've told you before of our friends who's 18-year-old son killed himself at home after school one day. I think it was a Monday. Yeah, it was bad, y'all. It was bad. It was really bad. I mean, he was an awesome kid. And the worst of it was just like, it was like out of nowhere. You know, I mean, you sort of imagine, well, maybe it was mental health or maybe there was something like that. No one could make any sense of it because it was like, here's this great kid. And, you know, the only sense of it is here's this great kid who frankly had a bad day and made a very poor decision. Ain't that the worst thing you've ever heard of? Nothing before that. Just a bad day. Made a bad decision. And it is so brutal and so horrific and so tragic and I think so seemingly pointless. And it can feel like Romans 8:28 is broken, right? I mean, or you can do what we kind of snarky Christians do. You know, they come behind and they, okay, well, you know, God's working this for good. And God's done some good things in it. Let me say that. You know, you talk to his mother, Katie. She is incredible. You know, she would say that there is a nearness and an intimacy with Jesus that she has learned since her son's death that she never would have known before. But let me tell you, if you're a parent, is that good? I mean, does that son's death warrant the growth and intimacy that she... I mean, not one of us who is a parent would ever trade that. In fact, it would always be the opposite. It's completely tragic. And I think the danger in the promise that says, oh, God works all things for good is, you know, that though it's an incredible comfort, if it is not seen with an eschatological horizon, it can be a doctrine of incredible abuse. I don't think that the good that the Robinsons are going to experience is going to be felt on earth. Like, I know they can go out and like they can start an organization for, you know, teenagers with mental health and everybody can do a 5K and sponsor them for 10 cents a mile, blah, 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 blah. You know how that is. Stand up at the end of the press conference and say, well, this really makes his death worthwhile. I'm sorry, that doesn't count for me. No way. We don't have to sit here and say there's an immediate good for Romans 8:28 to be true. We don't have to say the Robinsons learned something valuable. And isn't that great that that happened? You know what we do? We weep and we wait for heaven. I think one day we're going to get there and God's going to reveal the good. I'm going to explain it. He's going to make sense of it. It might have been hard, but there will be an answer and there will be a good. Ultimately, Romans 8:28 is a promise that will be revealed one day, that God works all things for good for those that love him and are called according to his purpose. Then Paul moves on. In verse 29 and 30, he starts talking about what seems to be a totally different subject. He starts talking about this thing we might call the order of salvation, and it seems like a sort of stark and strange change, but Paul hasn't changed ideas here. That is, that the surety that God works all things for good rests on the truth and the substance of verse 29 and 30. Look, I should be taking about 6 sermons with this passage. We don't have the time on that. These two verses are huge, but I want to show you why the surety that God works all things for good rests on the truth and the power of verse 29 and 30. So let me just take a minute here. Hang with me. We're going to do this. I'm going to exegete this for you. I'm going to define it. And then I'm going to tell you what the outcome of it is for a second. So this verse 29 and 30. Look, this is called the golden chain. The golden chain, that is, that these are 5 interlocking links to your salvation. And there is an order to them. They flow from one to another. They are meant to be what we call the order salutis, the order of salvation that God has revealed in this big and beautiful way. Let me walk through them with you for a moment and define each of them. The Lord says, for those whom he foreknew... This fore, that is before time. That's when the fore was. And what he's saying here is that your salvation began before you were created, before the world was created, before time. And when he says foreknew, Paul is not speaking of God's knowledge to sort of beam up the Star Trek, look into the future thing. That's not the context of this. The context of knowing is the Old Testament sense of the word knowing. There's a lot of verses, but it's comes from like an Amos 8:2, where God says about the people of Israel that I have known you amongst all the peoples of the earth. Well, of course God knew Israel, and he knew the Syrians, and he knew the Gentiles. He knows that's not what he's saying. When he says, I have known you before amongst all the tribes of the world, he's saying that I have loved you before all the peoples of the world. He's saying that I have covenanted with you to be my people. And when he says, so when he talks about it in Romans 8:28, it's not so much that he's foreknown as much as he is foreloved. He has foreloved you, his people. Your salvation begins not with you. It begins in the forelove of God for you before time. You should think about that on your ride home. That's a good truth. Secondly, now listen to how they go together. He says, those whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. Now, the image of his son here is what I think it's a picture of salvation. That is that God is conforming us. He's making us holy. He's bringing us into adoption as sons like Jesus. We become to be like Jesus. And he predestined us. Again, that pre is the word from before time. And I know probably for most of you in here, that word predestined is an awful word. You have only heard it spoken of in awful terms by preachers. And I would guess you've probably never heard a sermon on a passage like this because most preachers don't want to preach a passage like this. They want to skip it because they don't like the word. Folks, this is a good word. This is a beautiful word. And it's not my word. It's not a reformed word. It's a scriptural word. And that means it's good. And here's why. The glory of this link is that God has foreordained your salvation to him. He has before time set that it would be, that your salvation is not secured by your ability to behave the right way or to think the right way or to act the right way or to hold on the right way, that your salvation is secured by the sovereign grace of God determined before time. That is a hope and a joy. Those he predestined, he called. Calling is the third link of this. Calling is where you experience the sovereign grace of God, so that you will hear me in sermons and I will call you. I will say, if you have not put your faith in Jesus Christ, come to believe in Jesus. That is a call, but it is not the calling that is being spoken of here, because I throw it out there, but that's not what God does. This is an effectual call, so that when I say that, those whose God is working in their life, he will effectually call them to himself. God doesn't offer, he effectually calls. And his call doesn't return void. Those he calls comes. And if you're a Christian, you can describe the irresistible grace by which God called you to himself. Those he called, he justified. Remember, we said that justification comes by faith through grace. This idea that herein is our faith. There's a necessity that is the work of God, and yet God calls us to faith all at the same time, and he justifies us. And those whom he justifies, he glorifies. The glorification here, that's the picture of the end of days when you have been put into your resurrection body and you have been seated with Jesus into heaven, that you are glorified, and it's something that God will do. It's an order of salvation. It's a golden chain. Those he foreknew, he predestined. Those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he glorified. Man, I could do a lot with this, but I want you to notice two things. First is I want you to just look quickly at the verb tense of all of the golden chain links. You notice that? They're all in the past tense. Now, at least one of them is yet to happen for all of us in this room, glorified, unless you're some kind of angel sitting here, which I don't think any of you are. But even more than that, I mean, Paul wrote this 2,000 years ago. At least half the golden chain was yet to happen to us in this room, and yet Paul writes about them in the past tense. Why? Because God is so sovereign, you can book it. God is so powerfully sovereign that though it is yet to come, you and I can speak of our salvation and our glorification and our justification in the past tense. Secondly, I want you to notice the subject of these verbs. Notice who the subject is not. You. You did not justify yourself. God did. You did not call yourself. God did. You did not forelove yourself. God did. You will not glorify yourself. God will. And I think the picture of these verses, of the tense, of the subject, of the content, they point to one really big, great truth. A God-centered vision of salvation. The salvation, the scriptures are saying, is not me-dependent or me-driven. It is not human-engineered or humanly possible. The salvation is the power of God. It's the work of his sovereign grace. And this is really, really important. Because the surety that God works all things for your good rests on his sovereignty to save. Paul is saying the Romans 8:28 is being proven and should be trusted. Because God has the power to save you for eternity, from eternity, that God has put on display his majesty and his wonder and his power and his providence and his sovereignty over all things in saving you. And that turns out is the evidence that God can work all things for your good. If God is sovereign enough to foreordain my salvation, then he is sovereign enough to work for good in this terrible situation I find myself in. If God is sovereign enough to overcome my rebellion and my sin, then God is sovereign enough to work this evil in my life for something beautiful. I pray that you might know the glory and the hope and the joy of a God-centered salvation. I pray that this wouldn't just be theology for you. I pray it would be a foundation for hope. I pray it would be surety in trial. I pray it would lead to trust in God in the midst of suffering. Well, let's pray.